Good morning, friends. Please join with me in a brief prayer. Father in the heavens, we appeal to you as disciples of Yahshua that you grant us a good Sabbath, a safe Sabbath, a thought-provoking Sabbath, a blessed Sabbath. Please grant the words of my mouth and meditations of my heart to be pleasing in thy sight, Yahweh, our strength and our Redeemer. We open up our hearts and minds to you this Sabbath. Please, Father, come on in. You and Yahshua both as promised. In Yahshua's name always. Amen. Hallelujah. You can all be seated. Let's see. We got a new setup here. We're going to have to be patient as we adjust to these new resources that we have. Oh, there's the stuff behind me. Maybe I can use that as my guide, huh? Brothers and sisters, I'm Brother Michael Bannock from Fulton, Missouri. May all the grace of Yahshua be yours. My remarks today are entitled, Yahshua's Masks. That looks like clickbait to me, Yahshua's Masks. I can just see people. I hope you find a way to work that into the thumbnail on YouTube. Because people are going to say, what, Yahshua's Masks? Is he like a phony or something? Well, Yahshua comes to us in disguise. In fact, through Yahshua, Yahweh comes to us in disguise. And I'll be talking about some of those disguises today. In the image you see there, I had to think about this for a while. No matter what mask I put up there, it would likely not be appropriate. So I chose the No drama from Japan. Those three masks you see there is actually one mask, but you're looking at it from different perspectives. And the one on the left, the mask is kind of down. The camera is oriented so that you're looking from the top, kind of. Hope I got that right. Yeah, and it looks like it's kind of happy. And the one on the far right looks kind of scared. It's the same mask, but in this carefully calibrated brand of Japanese drama, the emotion of the character is actually controlled by the perspective you're allowed to have on the mask. I thought, well, that's kind of appropriate. That's the mask of a woman, three different expressions. I don't know how to characterize the one in the middle, but you get the idea. Yahshua is all over the place. He's all around. He's filled the room here. But he's in other places too. But how are you looking at him? Will adjust what you think and how you perceive them. And Yahshua said, if you see me, you've seen the Father. So this is actually Yahweh coming to you in disguise. Now, the way these resources are working today, I'm going to have to, on occasion, look behind me, make sure we got the slide we want. Okay, here we go. I've just decided that... Okay.
Sorry.
That's Lucas, our stage monkey. Okay. Well, I've decided from now into the future, I'm always going to try to work in some edifying or educational or evangelical material before I get to the main show. And here's something. A lot of what you're going to hear today I've talked about before. I'm just looking at it from different perspectives today. And I hope you don't see this as me just recycling old material. But I've been asking a lot of people this question lately. This is something to put on your refrigerator. If your main purpose in life is to not sin, what would you change? Yahshua's purpose in life, every morning when he got up, he had to make absolutely sure he did not sin. Think about it. One sin and he blows the whole program. The whole thing's lost. Why isn't that your top priority if it's not? Sin is your mortal enemy. Right now, think about it. What is there in your life that's increasing the likelihood of sin? What risks are you taking? Our friends at Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about people, places, and things. Are there people, places, and things in your life that are increasing the likelihood of sin? Yahshua told us to pray that we not enter temptation. Go ahead and laugh at me for the things that I won't do, the places I won't go, the things that I've thrown out in my home and my space. Go ahead and laugh at me. Because if these things lead you to temptation, the joke's on you. The stakes are so high. I've been asking this question a lot lately. What will change in your life if zero sin is the objective? And don't come to me later and say, well, we're allowed to have a little sin. Or my favorite, he winks at sin. No, he doesn't wink at sin. He winks at ignorance. Yeshua said in one of the forward-looking parables, he said that he who knows what to do but doesn't do it, he'll get many stripes. But he who doesn't know will receive few stripes. Notice that the guy who doesn't know what to do, he still gets stripes. That's your tip-off that you got to go learn your sacred duty. Here's another one I've been asking people lately. This is another refrigerator note. If you were wrong about something, who would you trust to tell you? This one's really eating away at me because I think I have the same experience as all of you. I think everybody here knows somebody in their lives who's heedless. They just won't listen. They throw themselves into the arms of risks and immorality and dumb things, just dumb, ill-conceived things. If you were wrong, who could approach you and tell you, hey, hold on a minute. Hang on a minute. To whom do you give such privilege to approach you? And furthermore, what are you doing to build such trust? If you're going to be the one to approach somebody with their sin, what are you doing to build the trust so that you have standing in their eyes? So what are some of the things you can do to build trust? Why would you guys even listen to me? What, because YRM threw me on the stage? Because YRM let me out of my cage for the weekend and said I could come up here and give a message? Does that lend weight to my remarks? What have I done to earn your trust? Have I spoken the truth? Have I been faithful in my words? Have I been faithful in my interactions with you? Here's an idea. Over there on the side, you'll see Dennis Prager. He's a prominent radio commentator right now. He's Jewish. He's somewhat friendly to Christians. He says that when the Messiah has come, the first thing he's going to ask him is, were you here before? He said that one of the reasons he believes the Bible is because it advertises the flaws and the shortcomings of the characters. Well, that's not how we think. We are wired, we are pre-wired to cover up our mistakes and to advertise our successes. We're inclined to boast about what we've achieved and what we've accomplished. And, oh, then there's this business of boasting about what you're going to do down the road. But who really has the courage to admit their flaws and their errors? You can build long-term trust, and I don't mean quick, snappy Tom trust, but you can build long-term trust by being candid about your errors, your flaws. There's a passage in James where he says, confess your faults often one to another. I suppose when I was a Catholic, I might have saw that as an endorsement of the confessional ritual. But now I see that as a call to candor and vulnerability and transparency with one another. Our friend, Elder Dwayne Wilson, from the assembly up in Illinois, he and the ministry team have decided on five things among them, five commitments among the ministry team, just the ministry team. Now, I might get these a little out of order, but the first one is humility. The next one is transparency. Number three is accountability. And number four, that's the money ball. Number four, confrontability. Confrontability. Are you confrontable? Before Dwayne ever told me that, I made a decision years ago, I'm going to be confrontable. You know, when I'm wearing these tassels, people in the world sometimes ask, what are you doing there with those things hanging from your belt loops? I say, now that you've noticed them, I'm giving you permission to call to my attention any time that I fall short. It's okay. Tap me on the shoulder. Let's get back to the previous slide, or an earlier slide. If my objective is to stop sin, I've got to be confrontable. I don't want, let me tell you, gang, if you ever get a glimpse of the kingdom, of how good it can be, nothing else matters. What? Oh, I got a fault I got to get rid of? Let's get to work on this. In our outreach, we presume to be telling you out there in ministry land, outreach land, we presume to be telling you what to fix, tune up, restore, reform. Surely we too must be open to that. Well, I think that's it on today's refrigerator notes. Let's see. Let's talk about Yahshua's masks now. The first clue comes from the book of Proverbs 19, verse 17. He that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto Yahweh, and that which he hath given will he pay him again. So Yahweh himself identifies with the poor. This does not comport with the hip modern go-go prosperity gospel, does it? In fact, we will find that Yahshua identifies with all the people in the backwash. I remember Yahshua said there, I think it's near the end of Luke 11. I could be wrong. Oh, I have a Bible here. I might be able to verify that. But he says, that which is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the eyes of Yahweh. When's the last time you've meditated on that? Think about that. The things that you maybe cherish after sundown, those may be the very things that Yahweh hates. Well, that's a first clue about Yahweh identifying with the poor. You're lending to Yahweh, and he's going to pay you back. Now, to keep it in balance, there's another clue here. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous shows mercy and giveth. So you find the righteous pay back when they borrow, and the righteous give. Yeah, I don't think it's going to... I'm not going to find the thing I'm looking for in Luke 11 right now. But anyway, I know it's in there. If something is highly esteemed in the eyes of men, Yahweh says, yuck. What kind of reorientation of our values would that lead to? What kind of righteousness would that lead to? Well, I don't like talking sideways like this, but I hope you guys will... give us some grace here, because I don't have a presentation of the slides in front of me. I'm going to turn to the side to look at them. Thank heavens we have this big, beautiful screen. Hey, why don't I do like the other guys do on YouTube, where they walk far from the podium? Okay, I'm going to be like them. Well, I better be careful, because I might start walking among you. Okay, I'll go back here. Yahshua's masks. Let's start with Judaism. Judaism has developed a vast theology about charitable giving. Look up Maimonides' Eight Principles of Charity. And you see they had this thing all worked out, this whole thing about charity. By the time Yahshua arrives, charitable giving is called tzedakah, righteousness. And that's the technical term in Judaism for charitable giving. Tzedakah. Oh, just a side note. How many have heard of the musician Neil Sedaka? How many have heard of Neil Sedaka? Got all these young people here, they never heard of Neil Sedaka. I didn't know Neil Sedaka was Jewish until I went to the Jewish bookstore on Devon Avenue in Chicago. And there was audio tapes of him doing Jewish cantors. Well, why is that interesting? Because Neil Sedaka, his last name Sedaka, that's the word for righteousness. Neil Sedaka was Jewish. Well, anyway, in the Hebrew Matthew, Yahshua calls charitable giving tzedakah in the Great Sermon on the Mount. Now, this connection of charitable giving with righteousness comes from Daniel's admonition to King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4:27. He has this bad news interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And he says, "Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, tzedakah, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor." Now, this is one of the tickets to heaven, giving to the poor. If you remember Cornelius in the book of Acts, his alms and his fastings and his prayers were a memorial before Yahweh. And he got a direct revelation. That's gold. Now, Daniel gave him this recommendation that it may be a lengthening of his tranquility. It looks like Nebuchadnezzar ignored him because he was slammed with the bad news in that dream. But that's where you get the connection between righteousness and charitable giving. Remember when Paul the Apostle met the other apostles in Jerusalem, they were a little puzzled by each other's ministry because Paul was going to minister to the Gentiles. But one thing they agreed on with certainty is that they would remember the poor. These are the people Yahshua comes to us in disguise. We're going to talk about the forward-looking prophecy Yahshua gave us about the day of reckoning, the sheep and the goats. It's in Matthew 25, verse 31 and beyond. Yahshua identifies with unattractive cases. Remember, we're attracted to the guy with the gay clothing, the guy who's hip, erudite, flashy, conversational. These are Yahshua's buddies up here. Hungry, thirsty, stranger, naked, sick, and in prison. I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. Naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came unto me. You know, there's a lot of big talk out there about pronouns today. You notice, oh, well, what's your pronoun? Here's my pronoun. There's only two pronouns in there. I and you. I was sick and you came to see me. Those are the only two pronouns in there. We're going to go through each of them. I'm going to do kind of a Rorschach, kind of a reaction to them, give you some thoughts on them, maybe some new thoughts, new perspectives, about how we're dealing with this today, how things may have changed since Yahshua's time, but to get your thoughts flowing about the people who Yahshua, through whom Yahshua is coming right to you. And they will not be attractive. They will not be glitzy. I hope some of you are cringing over those parts of your heart that are still titillated by what men esteem, that's highly esteemed in the eyes of men. I was hungry and you gave me food. There's a lot to this. In fact, there's a lot to the whole list that I'm going to mention at once. This whole business of charitable giving is different today than in Yahshua's time. Life was really hard in Yahshua's time. And we have almost eliminated starvation around the world. Not 100%. I'm going to estimate maybe 85% of the world has been cured of hunger. Progress is being made. Now there's powers that be who are hindering that by trying to cut off energy sources and things. But like in this country, it's hard to starve in this country. No, in this country, you have to really work at starving, all right? You have to really work at it. Now, there are people who turn it into a racket. And this has been going on for a long time, where the people claiming to be poor will claim ownership of certain corners in the busy streets of the big cities. And that'll be like their territory. And they'll collect money and claim to be hungry. And sorting this out is difficult. I know that. But there are still people who are hungry. And I know it's hard to sort out who really deserves it and who doesn't. But there's a longstanding method of dealing with this. If someone confronts you on the street and says they're hungry, one way to do it is to stop what you're doing and take them to a restaurant. And there are people who have done this. Okay, I know some. I was hungry and you gave me food. Now, one thing that we see a lot of today is food baskets for the poor. Now, I'll talk about that in a minute, but I should point out that a number of the saints wind up at food banks around here. because distributing the food and getting it organized and packaged up for people is a significant part of keeping the problem away. But if you ever wind up donating to food baskets, when I was a boy, my family were candidates to receive Thanksgiving baskets. And I recall getting, I remember looking at that basket, and I think it was a cardboard box. You could tell some people were thinking about us, putting themselves in our shoes, and others were not. At least 2 years in a row, we got a frozen stiff turkey on that Wednesday night before Thanksgiving. How about it, girls? It's very hard to have Thanksgiving turkey ready in time if you got a rock-hard frozen turkey Wednesday night. But my mom made the best of it. We wound up eating kind of late on that Thursday. So they weren't thinking ahead that much. Maybe getting out those baskets was a last-minute operation. But I also remember in one of those boxes a gourmet chocolate pudding. It was like a mousse. And Mom never made it. I made it myself one day, just as a boy. I made it myself. But if you ever donate things, you know, non-perishables, to a charity basket or those collection centers, I'd like you to think about those people and think about their humanity. One might argue, I suppose, that they should be satisfied with cans of peas and things like that. But Yahshua says he comes in disguise as the poor. Book of Proverbs says Yahweh comes in disguise as the poor. You should think about throwing into that basket something that's gourmet, something high-end, something that lets them get their mind off their troubles for a little while. Let's reflect off the next one. I was thirsty. Oh, let me back up to hungry just a bit. In pursuant to this broadcast series we're working on, I've had to do some research into the early history of the Messianic faith. And one of the things that popped out is there was a teaching, I'm talking about documents outside the Bible, where they told believers who were fasting that they should take the food they would have eaten and give it to the poor. Now, that never occurred to me. Whenever I have fasted, I thought, okay, I saved a few bucks on food today. What really happens, though, is I wind up almost eating the same amount of food the next 3 days after that. I don't know if you've noticed that. You might lose some weight and lose a fraction of an inch on your girth, but somehow it comes back, you know. But it never occurred to me to take the money I might have spent on food that day and give it to the poor. But that's something you should think about. If you're fasting for a day, it's very reasonable to say, whatever I would have eaten, the value of that could, would, and should go to the poor. It's something to think about. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. Now, yeah, this has nothing to do with going to bars and buying people drinks, okay? It has nothing to do with that. But back then, having a good drink was rare. It was hard to get a good drink of water. Paul recommends in one of his letters that they have some wine and not so much water. Finding clean water was hard, and some people stirred some wine in there as an antiseptic. Anyway, thirst is not a big issue today as it was back then. However, there are ministries that work on drilling wells in faraway places for people who need it. Now, one of those charities is called Gift of Life. I don't even know if they're still in business, but you could go poking around and help them out. There was a birthing center that some friends in Kenya wanted to put up, and they had to put a hold on it and throw the money at their well because the well was kicking out salt water, and they had to drill down deeper. Now, I should tell you, for decades, whenever I found out somebody does missionary work, the first thing, there's two things I ask them. Who do you trust in the village? Number two, how are you getting your water? Because water is real foundational. But there's people out there who need water on the other side of the world, and they just need people to come in with technology and drill it up. Now, this thing about the stranger, I'm going to talk about that in a bit. I'm going to skip it now and come back to it in a bit. The next one, naked and you clothed me. It's kind of hard to go naked in America, I'll tell you that. Again, there's lots of clothing sources and clothing drives. But I'm curious, with all this ripping and running I've been doing, do we still have that coat racks for the winter coats in Jeff City? Yeah, there's coat racks in Jefferson City. One of the sisters here got involved in starting that. You just put a coat there you don't need. And I understand that there's been some observers who watched that and made sure nobody's been double-dipping coats. But in the wintertime, they've needed coats. Let's talk a little bit more about this naked and you clothed me stuff. Let's get real. Let's get real. How many of you have too few clothes in your closet? How many of you just too few, just so little? Yeah, if you're in America, you're already among the 1%. A few years ago, I cleaned out my closet, brought a whole bunch of stuff down to that place where they sell clothes real cheap, that Mercy store, you know, a dollar for a pair of trousers, something like that. But now I look at my closet and I think, well, wait a minute, I already cleaned this out. Why do I still see far more than I need? Every one of us in our house has a closet with more than we need. Can we get real? Please, let's get real. We got way more shoes than we need, way more clothes than we need. John the Baptist says, you got two coats, give one to him who has none. We have a whole lot more than we need. Let's talk about sick, and you visited me. Yeah, being in the hospital is tough. Now, how do I want to say this? See, there's a lot of places people can be sick. They can be sick at home, they can be sick in the hospital, and they can be sick in a nursing home. They could be slipping, or they could be like a candidate for extended care. This is where you have to ask yourself, how smart are you? How smart are you? Do you think you're smart? Do you think you're average? Think you're above average? Do you think you're informed? Almost everybody in here spends a good deal of time on media right now. When it comes to visiting the sick, they spend a lot of time rotting there. And it's always been that way. When you visit the sick and the afflicted, you got to put some brain power into how you're going to make that go. Now, I've been single all my life, but I do know what it is to prepare for a date. And there are some people who turn dating into, now I believe in courtship instead of dating, but the objective's the same. All of you who've been at one time or another in a courtship, before you go out with that person who's a candidate for life partnership, don't you put some brain power into what you're going to do and what you're going to talk about? You should do that when you visit the sick and the afflicted. Can you bring them things? Another one is to say, hey, can I run an errand for you? What can I get for you? Can I go to Lee's and pick up some of that yummy chicken for you? Whatever. If you're going to put all this brain power into these attractive things in your life, should you not do the same thing when you visit the sick and the afflicted? Let's see what I have next. Okay, we're going to go back to the stranger. I wanted to put that near the end. Well, there's a lot of talk in the news about immigration, isn't it? I just wonder, I wouldn't want to ask for a show of hands because I wouldn't want to embarrass anybody. But I got to think, if you have Yah's spirit inside of you, have wondered, how does current immigration policy play against the command to love the stranger? The Bible has high-impact commands about loving the stranger. In fact, one of them says, you were a stranger in the land of Egypt. You're supposed to know what that's like. For the next few minutes, I'll be talking about this, a little bit about immigrants, and I'll be talking also about strangers here. All right, we build a big building. We furnish it. We invite people to come to the feast. All things are ready. Come to the feast. We are going to have people come here who are looking for a spiritual home. They're looking for a spiritual family. I want them to meet a spiritual home and spiritual family. But some of these people are going to be awkward, unaccustomed. Some of them take a while to get to know. I was a stranger and you took me in. Now, I have the same concern some of you do. I do not want people coming here and defrauding us. And that's why we have rules. So, those of you who are coming for the feast, we welcome you. We want you here. Best way to get into the feast is to volunteer for chores. We always have a need for people to step up and help with chores. And it's okay if you don't do it perfectly first time. We'll give you some tips. And on occasion, we might have to knock on your door and say, hey, it's Sabbath. You shouldn't be playing that music in there on Sabbath. Or it's Sabbath. You shouldn't be loading clothes into the wash machine. We're really trying to preserve what Yahweh declares as holy. Almost everybody here has been approached on that wavelength in the course of their fellowship with us. Hey, Brother Mike, you should have handled that differently. You should have said it differently. That's okay. That's okay. Remember, I mentioned confrontability. We have to be approachable. We have to gin up the courage to approach the stranger, and the stranger has to approach us. Now, there's parts of the Bible that talk about bringing strangers into your home. When I read that, I bet I have the same hesitancy you do. Well, if I invite a stranger in my home, maybe they're not going to follow the same rules I have. Remember, I had one guy in my house. He was a brother in the faith. His schedule was like opposite. He'd sleep all day, and all night long he'd be puttering around the house. I said, look, this has got to stop. Actually, if I invited somebody into my home now, I'd require them to pray when I pray, eat when I eat, and have rules. Back then, having a stranger in your home might have been easier because everybody was in the same culture. Let's talk just a little bit about the immigration issue. Actually, the immigration problem could be solved very quickly. For those who feel very fervent and passionate about it, I'm not kidding. This problem can be fixed real quick among us who feel very strongly about welcoming immigrants to the country. And that is through sponsorship. Sponsorship. Now, I sponsored an immigrant from Africa. And it wasn't very... Remember, I'm just a freewheeling bachelor, and having another guy in the house wasn't that hard. And it helped because the guy was already in the faith. But he was a stranger in a strange land. But those who feel fervently about immigration, they could, would, and should open the doors of their homes. But they're going to have the same question we all have if we invite someone in our home. And that is, are you going to play by the same rules I play by? Are you going to be up all night, you know, watching TV, or are you going to bring pork in the house? I've done a little research. It appears that when immigrants come in through normal channels, something happens that speaks to the scriptures. Remember, the scripture does say, welcome the stranger, but it also says one law for the stranger and the one who's native born. And when people come into the country properly, they are coached on the need to obey the laws of the land. One of the reasons we have so much chaos right now in the world of immigration is because a lot of them don't get any coaching on, here's the laws you got to follow, here's who you're going to report to. You know, they're not engaged as though this is a serious connection with us. Engaging the stranger means that we have to build a bridge to them and they have to build a bridge to us. When people come here for the feast, I want us all to be as hospitable and friendly as we can. And for those of you who join us for the feast, please understand there's going to be rules here. There's going to be constraints on our behavior. And that is messianic. to defer to one another, to be mindful of other people's tastes. We have like a quiet hour. I forget what it is. Do we shut down at 10:30 or whatever? But it's posted. And by the way, I broke the rules once and people come to me. I remember practicing my guitar at like midnight. I got dinged for that, and they were right, and I was wrong. Let's go down to the prison thing. Why in the world would Yahshua be represented in a prison? Come on now, they're in there for a reason. What did they do? Did they steal? Did they swindle? Did they destroy property? Did they murder? What did they do? Why are they in prison? They belong there. Let them rot. I mean, that might be what comes to your mind. I don't know. But there's one thing you've got to understand. The Bible, the Torah, makes no provision for prisons. None. In Yahweh's law, it's either payback restitution, shalom, payback what you took plus a penalty, and that depends on the situation, or stripes. They take your shirt off and they whip you in the town square. There's a famous story of, I think, an ambassador's son who got caught stealing in Southeast Asia. And this kid claimed that he had immunity because his dad was an ambassador. They said, no, you don't get immunity. And they caned him in the town square. And there was an international outcry. And I think it was Bill Clinton, the president, appealed to the government, oh, please have mercy on the boy. But in a later interview, he said, while I was getting caned, I thought, ooh, I don't want this to happen again. In the scriptures, you're either going to get stripes or payback or capital punishment. You don't go to jail. You don't go to jail. In Yahweh's economy, there is no jails. The reason why I was in prison, you came unto me. The reason that's in there is because prisons are inhumane. We're stuck with them. Let me tell you a little bit insight about what's going on here. It was a difference in perspective on crime that got us to the situation we're in now. In Roman law, which we've inherited some of Roman law, in Roman law, when you commit a theft, you've committed it against society. And so you wind up in jail as a debt to society. But in Hebrew law, you hurt an individual, and you need to make peace with them. And if I could reform the justice system, we would orient it toward making shalom. Because I can guarantee you, if somebody, I got to speak hypothetically, if one guy steals from another, and then the judge tells him, you got to pay back what you owe, and if you can't afford it, you're going to have to do chores for him for a month. I guarantee you, when that month is ended, they will bond. They will bond. They will become connected emotionally. I was in prison and you came to me. This is like visiting the sick and the afflicted. Remember what my challenge to you. If you're going to prepare for dates, courtship, outings, fun, and goofing off, if you're going to put all this brain power and energy into that, you could, would, and should be doing that kind of investment for the sick and the afflicted and the people in prison. I'm going to talk now about a common temptation for Sabbath keepers, and I'll tie it into this business about Yahshua's coming in to us in disguise. First, I'm going to give you a warning because I'm going to challenge you today. I'm going to challenge you. But I mean, some of you come a long way for Sabbath meeting. You'd like to be challenged today, I hope, you know. Deuteronomy 29, verse 19, when Moses is giving that great sermon, he mentions something about what goes on in people's hearts when they're convicted. And it come to pass when he heareth the words of this curse that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of mine heart, to add drunkenness to thirst. And I know that feeling. Maybe you've had that experience too. But there's times when I've walked in darkness like that, where I hear Yahweh's word, I'm convicted of his word, I know it's the truth, but I'm going to go do what I want to do anyway. I'm going to have peace. even though I reject his word. And that doesn't pay off, I should tell you right now. That does not pay off. It is a common temptation for Sabbath keepers to use Sabbath as a preparation day for after Sabbath activities. I've had to confront this. I don't have to spy on people. I don't have to take notes. I know being a Sabbath keeper since my youth, constantly tempted with this, turning Sabbath into a preparation day for things after Sabbath. One tragic case many years ago, a guy wanted to leave the feast early. I said, why are you leaving early? It's the last day of Tabernacles. Where are you going? And he blushed. And then he admitted he was going to Branson. Is Yahweh's feast that dull? I mean, usually we don't want to leave. Why would you want to leave the feast early? To go to Branson? That which is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the eyes of Yahweh. What did he go do down there at Branson that was so important that he couldn't stay for the feast? Well, this is many years ago. The guy's no longer with us. I think it's reasonably safe to cite that. But a temptation you'll be confronted with if you're a Sabbath keeper is that this holy time that Yahweh has set out, you'll think, well, we're not doing anything. That Michael Bolton concert, it's starting like an hour after sunset, and it's about an hour and a half from here. You'll be tempted to fudge and color outside the lines. Now, there's a reason I'm bringing this up. How might we instead use Sabbath time to engage in righteousness? We have a prayer list going. Okay, now recently some of the guys got started again with the prayer list downstairs. How come we can't be doing that on Sabbath? I noticed, hallelujah, many of you come up here later in Sabbath and practice songs. That's glorious. That's music to Yahweh's ears. How about visiting the sick and the afflicted? I mean, if you really want to go do something on Sabbath, why not visit the sick and the afflicted? And countless other things that we can do on Sabbath. If we can't find ways to make Sabbath a fulfilling spiritual experience, then we should think harder, just like we think about other things we plan. Okay, I'm going to talk about Missouri Prison Ministry. Hold on, I'm going to go back. I think there was a note from the previous. Something coming up about prison ministry. I might have my slides a little mixed up in my head, but we'll get there. I'm going to talk about the Missouri Permanent Prison Ministry background. There was an aging minister down the road who developed a prison ministry here in Missouri. And he gained legal recognition for us as Messianics. Now, for years, the saints have been asking, what do we call ourselves? What do we call it? What do we? And you have all these great ideas about what we should call ourselves. And frequently in those conversations, people will try to pick a name that describes us. And some of these names get kind of long. But the word messianic works for the prison system in Missouri. That's a one-word label. Now, when I've been pressed, I explain that there's messianic Jews who bring a Jewish calendar and Jewish traditions into a messianic faith. And then there's messianic Gentiles. But for now, in the Missouri prison system, we're called messianics. And because of this aging minister's efforts, we have full accommodation in the Missouri prison system. And that's really kind of like Cadillac provision. For example, our constituents can ask for an all-kosher diet, and that will be brought in. And that's kind of quality. We have that drive for the matzos in the spring, and they support us in that. I think one of the things, I'm going to pause here, one of the things I wanted to say is about Sabbath. Because this is holy time that Yahweh has carved out. And it's the sign of his people. And I know what it is to be ants in the pants, wondering when sunset's going to be. I didn't have to get to this age to appreciate the Sabbath for what it is. But when I appeal to the Missouri prison system for accommodation on Sabbath, I've got a two-step problem on my hands. Now, I've accessed two books on prison ministry from 200 years ago. And 200 years ago, everybody treated Sunday as a Sabbath. And that's how it was until the Industrial Revolution. But since the Industrial Revolution, their Sunday Sabbath has now become a day of leisure. So I actually have three, when I appeal to the Missouri prison system to accommodate us, I got three things I got to knife my way through. Number one, I could have told you guys 200 years ago, whatever you do on Sunday, we want to do it on Saturday. That would have been good enough. But today, we're doing it on a different day. That's number one. Number two, it's a real Sabbath. It's not a day of it's not a day of leisure and goof off. It's a real Sabbath. Then the third layer is, even though it's a real Sabbath on seventh day, you're still going to have inmates who are coloring outside the lines, because you still have that in the Christian world. And there are Christian denominations that still teach Sunday as a Sabbath. With all this, I know, it's common for evangelicals to sing their lungs out for an hour or two and then go to restaurants, ball games, and things like that. Okay, we don't do that stuff. But we still have, amongst all Sabbath keepers, whether they be on a Sunday tradition or the true Seventh-day Sabbath, we have this constant temptation to color outside the lines. And I have to kind of smooth that over with the state-level chaplains and say, look, we want a real Sabbath like you had 200 years ago for Sunday keepers. We want it on the seventh day, and it's a real Sabbath, and you're still going to have some inmates color outside the lines, because I have no means of reaching in there and coaching them. Well, anyway, full accommodation in the Missouri prison system. We are recognized as a denomination right now under the banner of Messianic. I don't know about the other states in the Union, but we're called Messianic here. Now, there's a continuing need for such prisoners to receive personal visits. See, I mentioned that aging minister at the top. He is retired, and I was asked to fill in for him. And what that means is I occupy a chair at the state level where other chaplains come in there, and they advise the state chaplain, the big state chaplain, they advise him on accommodation requests. But I see there's a continuing need for prisoners to receive personal visits. And I found out it's actually not that hard to set that up. But it is very hard work. But it speaks to Yahshua's commands. No comparison is perfect, but I remember when I was in the dating age, I remember how hard I worked to find the right way to approach a lady. And it's good that you do that, guys. It's good that you put some thought into that before you do that. But why can't we do that kind of thinking before we approach prisoners? Find out what their needs are. Learn from our mistakes. Build on that. So I'm going to do a typo here. Are you projecting the PowerPoint file itself? Yes? Could you change that number 3 to a 5 up there at the very top line? If you can't do it, fine. But so this is an appeal I'm making to those of you who feel led. If you've been baptized into Yahshua's name for over 5 years, not 3. 3's too soon. You've got to have some maturity. If you've been baptized into Yahshua's name for over 5 years, and you're in Missouri, and you're looking, I'm looking for volunteers to visit the prisons. You're visiting Yahshua in disguise. And I know you're probably going to have most. Remember, we heard about the 10 lepers who were cleansed and only one came back and gave thanks. We may have that too in the prison system, but I celebrate the one. I'm only looking for a 1-year to 3-year commitment because I don't think anything's in perpetuity except marriage and salvation. And I'm not looking to build an empire. I just want us to coordinate. The work is hard and at times confounding, but imagine how they feel. So you can contact me through RYRM. If you're in Missouri and you feel led to get in on this, we'll learn from our mistakes. We'll have conference calls. I'm more interested in coordinating than running anything. And I'd like you to give some thought to that. There are three things that I would emphasize when engaging somebody in a prison, given who we are. Our religion is duty-focused. It's duty-focused because that's what the Bible says. Commandments, mitzvahs, instruction, messianic character. But it's very duty-focused, and it's easy to lose sight of the fact that you're still saved by grace. And if you're in a prison environment where there's multiple levels of psychological conflict going on, it's easy to think, oh, I'm really great because I'm keeping some part of the law. The first thing I would want to impress upon them is that they're saved by grace first. They're under Yahweh's mercy. Let's face it, guys, we've seen people who get a little proud and high-headed. Now, I'm not talking about prisoners. Even in the ordinary world that we move and operate, people they plug into Yah's commandments, and they say, wow, this is great stuff, and it goes to their head. First thing I'd emphasize is that your own right hand cannot save you, and that's what Yahweh told Job. Second thing is the next two are tied for second, so I'll go with one of them arbitrarily. And urge upon them to obey them that have rule over them, to obey the guards, for they watch over your souls, it says in the book of Hebrews. That applies to us here, obey them that have rule over you. The greatest example of faith in all of Israel was a pagan soldier who understood authority. They should make friends with the guards. You should make friends with the pastor and the elders. You know, those who have rule, your parents, anybody who has authority in your life, you should make friends with them. And the other principle is life purpose. What life purpose, before I tell you my answer, what life purpose would you give someone in prison? It's kind of bleak. What would you give them as a life purpose? I would urge them to take all the classes they can, all the training they can, all the education they can, so that when they get out, they can be functional members of society. I would tell them to make that their life purpose, and certainly to learn to grow in grace and truth, to develop biblical disciplines. For those who are in prison for life or death row, it would be the same life purpose, to learn all they can so they can coach those who are getting educated, so they can become tutors in practical things. Maybe there's better things to urge upon the guys in prison. But those are the three principles that seem the most to me. So anyway, if you've been baptized into Yahshua's name for over 3 years and you're in Missouri, you can find me through YRM. I'd love to hear from you. If volunteers do not come forward, I'm just going to work with what I got. But in light of Yahshua's imperatives, it seems to me somebody out there ought to be into this. Somebody out there should be thinking of this. I want to emphasize coordinating. I'm not into bossing anything around, but it'd be nice to know. Here's the reason why we have to coordinate. I've only been in this for like 1.5 years, and we already got evidence of a guy who's double dipping. Okay? He's getting resources from two places. And it's good to coordinate and say, what's this guy asking you for? You know, well, here's what he got from me, and so on. I'm almost done, friends. Yahshua's masks. Through Yahshua, Yahweh himself identifies with the poor, the hungry, the naked, the sick, the stranger, the afflicted, the needy, and the incarcerated. that's not pretty. Some of it's very ugly. After we weed out the fraudulent cases, there is still a constituency which Yahshua counts as his brethren. And untangling that stuff takes a lot of work, I know. But there's plenty there to work on. In fact, if you're bored, you got the problem, because there's plenty there to work on. Once you discover that your interests and lifestyle are getting a bit too worldly, Yahshua's command to find him in these cases will inspire you to think harder. Here's one clue. If you are trespassing on Sabbath, it's time to recalibrate. Well, let's see. Where's the moderator? I'm winding down now. See, we got this big cavernous place now. Okay, I'm winding down, Brother Jose. You can come on up now. I thank you for your kind attention. May Yahshua reveal himself to you through all the people in which he is hiding in disguise. B'Shem Yahshua.